to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we are going to be talking a little bit about some of Trump's bombing campaigns and the things going on around that and some media politics here in the United States. But before we can move on, the United States today dropped a massive ordnance air blast GBU-43/B bomb on Afghanistan. The bomb, better known as the mother of all bombs, Moab bomb, is the largest non-nuclear bomb in the U.S. arsenal. And the weapon itself has never been used in combat before today. The bomb contains 11 tons of explosives, what might lead you to believe, and you'd be right, that it's massively destructive. Apparently, the goal of the strike was to take out some sort of ISIS tunnel complex in Afghanistan, and perhaps that was the main piece, but it's also worth noting this was the same province where ISIS killed a soldier 2 days ago, a U.S. soldier, in combat. So it seems like this might have been a little bit of a payback operation here designed to kill and maim many people, send some sort of John Wayne tough guy message that Trump seems to like. It also seems likely the military was giddy to test the weapon and see what happens when you use the bomb, how deadly their toy was, ultimately. It's also totally ridiculous. The U.S. has been in Afghanistan since 2001, waging a war and staffing an occupation. And now, the Taliban is stronger than they have ever been before, and now ISIS is operative inside of Afghanistan. So all the U.S. bombing, fighting, and killing has only strengthened America's so-called opponents. Now they are dropping giant bombs for payback and or as a petri dish to experiment with ordnance on live test subjects. Like all of Trump's foreign policy, it seems way more flash than substance or planning, with devastating results. Well, and President Donald Trump ran what many people consider to be an unconventional sort of campaign. He espoused many positions that seemed outside of the mainstream and took rhetorical aim at the so-called establishment on both the left and the right. While Trump was often like a flamethrower seeming to try to burn down the whole system, it really resonated with a lot of people because it had a certain truth to it. That politics is a rigged game controlled by the richest people and corporations that bend the rules in their favor really is not in dispute. Trump questioned major trade deals, military interventions, and pushed back on Republican orthodoxy in areas like Social Security and Medicare. However, as we reach the 100-day mark, it seems that Trump's campaign of rebel right-wing insurgents is morphing into a more or less status quo Republican presidency. Trump, for instance, said he wanted to have a health plan that covered everyone. Then promptly signed on to a Republican health care plan that would have immediately thrown tens of millions of people into the land of the uninsured. Trump also pledged to drain the swamp, then immediately filled his cabinet with Pentagon retreads, congresspeople, and corporate titans, people who mostly could only be described as the epitome of the establishment. He's put together all sorts of corporate advisory councils and tapped his son-in-law to run an office that tries to use quote-unquote business methods recommended by top executives into government. So again, not a ton of swamp draining. Trump railed against China the entire campaign, China, while promoting better ties with Russia. Somewhat of a reverse from what U.S. administration since Nixon had done, using China as a wedge to put pressure on the then Soviet Union and reverse the gains of the socialist camp. And then since then, just promoting ties with China and attempting to corral them more into the structures and processes of the post-Cold War international capitalist order. Now, Trump is refusing to label China a currency manipulator as he promised, is talking up cooperation with China while almost overnight dramatically ramping up tensions with Russia. Trump has said on the campaign trail that NATO was obsolete. He's now totally walked that back and said NATO is not obsolete and supported the accession of Montenegro to NATO and what could only be seen as a highly inflammatory move designed to further contain Russia. So what's going on here? Well, it seems fairly clear Trump is taking more advice from the plutocrats than the far-right radicals currently, or at least to the extent that those two don't overlap. There's a recent story in Politico, actually, about how a number of major CEOs, the Goldman Sachs alumni in the White House, and Jared Kushner have been teaming up to push Trump in a more centrist direction. The broad outlines here seem fairly clear given the major corporations and rich people, massive tax breaks, eliminating all regulations no matter the human cost, and a more predictable foreign policy more along the traditional lines of U.S. imperialism. And combined with an acquiescence here to the Trump campaign on the law and order deportation force style security state that's being built up at the expense of social programs is what this is all happening at. So, you know, it's a little mix of different things here. But of course, within this, despite all this different nuance, it doesn't really seem like the Trump regime is becoming the disruptive force a lot of people thought it was, and seems more directly centered now at delivering on the needs of capital while currying favor with enough of the right-wing electoral base to keep winning elections. So in some ways, a center-right force, although the residual right-wing elements are fairly extreme here, and the more centrist business-friendly practices actually could have a fairly radical effect in terms of concentrating wealth and power and the safety and welfare of human beings. But be that as it may, it seems that more or less two-thirds of Donald Trump's campaign promises appear to have been disappearing in thin air here. Maybe they weren't lies at the time, but certainly now they look that way. For all the talk about how there would not be a deportation force, new documents that were originally obtained by the Washington Post from inside the Trump administration, discussions in the Department of Homeland Security, seem to show that they are indeed doing everything possible to at least put the plan in place for said deportation force. The Trump administration has identified 33,000 more detention beds that could be used to house those they are planning on deporting. They're also laying the groundwork for plans to shift more immigration courts to the southern border regions, either virtually or in person. One plan could result in virtual immigration hearings where Mexico, if they were to agree to this, would hold third-party immigrants in detention centers on their side of the border, where they would receive hearings from U.S. immigration courts via video conference. And there's a second-track effort to establish courts on the U.S. side right there at various ports of entry and essentially accomplish the same thing. There's also a plan to start the border wall with a little proof of concept section in the Rio Grande Valley area. There are currently 37 localities working with the federal government on immigration issues that they've been deputized by ICE there. The newly released documents said that there's 18 more localities that have already communicated to DHS about wanting to get more involved in the deportation game, and that they have identified about 50 more who would probably be willing to participate. So, put all that together. Seems fairly clear here that the deportation force is coming. Well, if they can find a way to pay for it, that is. Looming over the documents is the cost of all this. For instance, Trump wants to hire 5,000 new Border Patrol agents and 10,000 new ICE agents, but the report itself notes that the cost of just 500 new agents is $100 million. The wall, that's already tagged at about $1.5 billion. Obviously, it's going to be more than that. The virtual courts would cost $50,000 per location, and Mexico would have to agree. And right now, Mexico is not agreeing. Moving more courts to the border on the U.S. side, much more expensive, $400,000 per location. Adding 18 more cities as a deputized deportation force would cost $19.5 million on top of the $24 million already being spent on this, and it would cost $75 million to add 50 more localities. There are also some other issues, which is immigration is actually down. So such massive outlays may not be able to find any sort of favor in Congress when it seems that to some degree they are a solution in search of a problem. Any close examination of immigration shows most of the claims coming from the Trump administration about it are somewhere between overhyped to outright fabrications. Also, the massive expansion of ICE, the Border Patrol, and police forces working with them is a human rights crisis in the making. ICE and CBP, for quite some time before Donald Trump, have been known for having really almost no oversight on their use of force and racial profiling activities. Most of the deputized local cops who have worked on this beat more or less just run dragnets that racially profile Latinos looking for the undocumented. So there could and almost certainly will be a decent amount of pushback if this deportation force is rolled out full force. But so far, it hasn't seemed like Trump has been shy on pushing forward aggressively on his immigration policy. So don't expect any less than a new deportation force sometime soon. And in case you had forgotten about it amongst all this other news, police brutality is still out there, still a big issue, and new videos emerging from around the country are reminding us of the potency and the prevalence of this issue. In Columbus, Ohio, a video has emerged of police officer Zachary Rosen stomping the head of DeMarco Anderson while Anderson is already cuffed and subdued. At one point, Anderson's head hits the pavement so hard from one of these kicks, it pops back up like a basketball. Rosen then puts the full force of his body into the suspect's neck, kneeling on it, while again, the suspect is hogtied and not resisting. Four other cops are just standing around watching, clearly with no real problem with what was going on. Now, Rosen is currently being investigated for what? I don't even really know. I mean, if the video isn't enough to get him fired, then more or less anything that's ever been said about the impunity of the police to brutalize people is confirmed times two. It's another video originating in Sacramento, California, capital of that state, where an officer stopped Nandy Kane Jr. for jaywalking. Kane, who obviously felt this was ridiculous, started to walk away and questioned why the officer even stopped him. They then have some words back and forth. Then just out of the blue, the officer rushes him, takes him down, starts punching him in the face. He then is grabbing his arm and saying, "I will break your arm," while beating Kane. The cop punched him at least a dozen times before another cop comes, handcuffs them. They then have a back and forth conversation. Then the police let him go. They noted they actually didn't have anything to charge him with. So the police stop a guy for jaywalking, and maybe he didn't even jaywalk. Then when the guy questioned the cop, questioned him, didn't attack him or anything, the guy, cop, pummels him simply for questioning why he was stopped. And while we're on this subject, we're at 332 people killed by police as well this year. We're on track to kill over 1,100 people by the end of the year, which is about 100 people more than last year, and in line with the roughly 1,000 people killed by police per year. And if you put all this together, it's just another reminder of the depth and the breadth of police brutality in this country. So while there are lots in the news that's taking up the headlines, don't forget incidents like the above are happening every day. And that's going to do it for today's Talking Points. And you are listening to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. And as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movement shaping the world.
By any means necessary.
And we are very happy to be joined in our conversation by Abby Martin, who is a journalist, the host of The Empire Files, which is a great show. Wow, I'm struggling a little bit here. weekly investigative news program. It's on Telesur. It is great, though, even though I inappropriately said show. Abby, thank you so much for joining us again.
Thanks so much, Eugene, for having me on.
No, of course, of course. I mean, this is such an interesting time in so many ways with so many different issues, I guess, good, bad, and indifferent. But one that I know is near and dear to your heart is the media, journalism, the way things are covered here in the United States. And, I mean, it just seems like a crazy time in some ways to be a journalist doing anything. I mean, it's like there's like a loyalty test now to even be considered legitimate.
Right. Yeah. I mean, if you look at just this whole proper not list, I mean, for example, like this is this McCarthyite blacklist tool that was circulated by the Washington Post, you know, and really in the air under the banner of fake news, right? Mm. This weaponized term that essentially has been handed to Trump, where he's just calling any news outlet that doesn't praise and worship his tiny hands and tiny brain as fake news. Well, that was started by this establishment concerted effort to essentially deflect, once again, all responsibility and blame and accountability for the abysmal campaign that they ran and why Hillary lost. And of course, instead of any reflection whatsoever, they've just been working, doubling down on this fake news hysteria. Proper not, we still don't really know who exactly is the financial behemoth behind this specific thing, but it definitely was used as a smear against alternative media, non-corporate media, basically any media that sit outside that binary of Republican versus Democrat. I mean, we saw sites like Truthdig, Truth Out, Counterpunch, Mint Press News conflated with InfoWars and Breitbart. I mean, it's really, really shocking to see something like Washington Post, which, you know, if you want to call something fake news, I mean, these outlets like New York Times and Washington Post are, yeah, they set the news for the Beltway, but Jesus, I mean, how many retractions did these publications make? Mm. I can only speak for myself, but when they were covering the DNI report, Russ Goldman or whatever, that guy who wrote the article about me, had to do like 5 retractions in one day. I mean, it was mortifying.
Wow.
So yeah, I mean, it's really interesting because people, of course, don't trust the mainstream media. They're getting desperate. And Trump, you know, uses this fake term now, and it's ultimately just extremely embarrassing. I mean, Washington Post, not only did they publish this proper not thing and try to say that this was, you know, some really serious thing that these news outlets should be investigated by the DOJ, but they also have published plenty of fake stories, I mean, including entertaining just any anti-Russian conspiracy theory under the sun. Like when Hillary passed out, they literally entertained that Putin could have poisoned her. I mean, it's just unbelievable. And then the New York Times has Louise Mensch, that Tory crazy wacko, who can say that Putin killed Breitbart. I mean, right. Putin carried out the terrorist attack in London. Putin did this. Putin did that. I mean, goddamn, is there anything that happens that Putin didn't do? But go ahead and give this woman the most sought-after editorial space in the world and give her carte blanche to just spout her crazy theories. So I know I kind of went off on her radar, but it is very interesting, this loyalty test of, like, if you talk about alternative media, if you talk about anything to the left of Hillary Clinton, then you are a Kremlin agent. You are covering for Russia. And I think it's extremely dangerous, Eugene, when, and we can get in the DNI report too, but it's extremely dangerous when simply talking about corruption, fracking, Wall Street greed somehow, you know, makes you a Kremlin agent. So.
No, I think that's a great point, and I'm glad you went off on it, because I had actually sort of somewhat forgotten about Louise Mensch. She said the thing yesterday about how even the Black Lives Matter movement was created by Russia.
That went too far, though. Someone was like, okay, now you went too far. It's like, why is that going too far?
But I'm glad you brought up the DNI report, because, I mean, you know, first and foremost, I mean, I'm curious, I mean, how does it even feel to even get put in something like that? I mean, it's like, I'm sure that they didn't, you know, call you ahead of time, and none of these news people ever said, like, hey, why don't we, before we start going with these wild theories, ask the people who are there to even be put in such a report. But also just the way that, you know, covering fracking and Occupy and all these different things, which, you know, you and others actually were at the time widely, you know, touted for having such great coverage, to then have that sort of branded as if this was just some sort of like fake thing.
Yeah, it was actually really embarrassing. I mean, we're talking about a multi-billion-dollar, probably, you know, could garner hundreds of billions of dollars. Like, the military-industrial complex is massive, right? And you have so much financial capability, manpower. They have the entire D.C. establishment at their beck and call. You know, they could have easily just called one of these think tanks and had, you know, Jamie Kirchick give up an RT write-up and give an update about, like, the last 2 years of Putin propaganda on the network. And instead, they took they dusted off some shelved thing from 2014, when my show was the most popular show on the network. It was a primetime show, and they basically just put together a very embarrassing report that was only criticizing RT's coverage of these exact things. I mean, it was so bizarre, Eugene. I just couldn't figure out why they didn't even try.
Right.
You know, and what's even scarier is all the people who just kind of accepted it as truth, and they're like, oh yeah, this is damning. Like, Rachel Maddow was like, this is a slam dunk. It's like, what is a slam dunk? Here we're being told that Russia, quote unquote, hacked our election. Doesn't mean anything. I mean, we're really just talking about hacking really just means, okay, John Podesta's emails were read, Debbie Wasserman Schultz's emails were read. Like, that's not hacking the vote. 52% of Democratic voters actually think that. But, you know, so we're all waiting this DNI report for, finally, what is the evidence? What is the evidence? Well, we're going to see something, right, after months of leading up to say that they have a slam dunk case. And it was just embarrassing. Half of the report was just about RT. And like we said before, I mean, it's talking about covering real issues. Half of this country is living in poverty. Half of the people living in this country are living paycheck to paycheck.
Right.
And they want to see real news. You're telling me that this is a Kremlin plot simply covering issues that people care about, that they're living. This is their reality. So I'm sorry that the corporate media likes to pretend like everyone's living in the 50s in the golden age of capitalism and everyone gets a shot. You just have to work hard and become a millionaire. But that's not the reality on the ground.
Mm.
So if you want to talk about why RT is popular, why is Telesur popular? Oh, if they want to make RT obsolete, start doing your goddamn jobs and fund independent journalism. Start taking concern about the abysmal state of media in this country and why people actually, young, eager journalists like you and me, Eugene, flock to outlets like RT, like Telesur, because it tells our viewpoint. It covers those radical voices that we just absolutely don't see in the rest of the country. And yeah, I mean, it really is filling that void. And, you know, instead the government's just passing laws and further consolidating and corporatizing mainstream media. And it's just making the problem even worse.
Mm-hmm. No, I think that is a great point. And we are going to take a break on that here and by any means necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. Stay with us.
By any means necessary.
Welcome back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And we are back having our conversation here with Abby Martin, who is the host of The Empire Files, which is a weekly show, investigative news show and program. It's on Telesur. It's fantastic, and I hope everyone checks it out. We're going to talk a little bit about that before we close here today. But, Abby, to keep sort of moving the line here that I think is interesting and just things that are happening right now. I mean, and speaking of things that are relevant to people and the way that they're playing out, I mean, one of the things that's crazy to me right now is just in the context of this, you know, Trump strike on Syria and the unbelievable, just uncritical reporting on what's going on regarding that. I mean, it's just like everything Trump says is true. All of a sudden, the media, which was saying that everything he says is a lie and he's fake, all of a sudden, everything he says is true and good and right, as long as it comes to like the military or whatever it may be. I mean, really just an unbelievable state of affairs, I think, in terms of actually trying to, you know, tell people what's going on.
It's extremely disturbing, Eugene, to see this so-called bastion, beacon of free press in this country, just echo state propaganda. I mean, what is scarier, having just straight-up state propaganda and a state-funded news outlet, or having a five giant corporate conglomerates actually just filtering top-down news and having all the pundits on every single station echo the exact same mantra of the military-industrial complex? I mean, that's to me, that's actually much more creepy and scary. I would much rather have just a U.S. state-funded media outlets channel just selling the war, and instead we have every single station, liberal, conservative, just selling the exact same line, Eugene. I mean, these are the same people that called Trump a mentally unfit puppet of Russia who should be impeached, right. Never trusted with the nuclear codes. He's suddenly more competent now to lead this country into another war. Let's go into another war in the Middle East behind Donald Trump, a reality star billionaire. I mean, it's unbelievable. Brian Williams called the bombs beautiful. These are bombs that went to kill multiple people, right? We're just killing people with bombs to show that killing children with chemicals is wrong. He's quoting Leonard Cohen. It's disgusting how many times he called these bombs beautiful. You have Fareed Zakaria saying Trump finally became president. Not to mention Maddow's praise of Tomahawk missiles, basically what just became a giant advertising blitz for 30 minutes. And whose stock went up? Raytheon. Who's invested in Raytheon? Trump. I mean, it's sick. Wow. Of the top 100 newspapers, 47 ran editorials on Trump's Syria airstrikes, 39 in favor.
Wow.
7 were ambiguous. Only one was opposed. And if you're looking at the state of where the people's minds are at, I mean, at least half of the country is split. It's actually the lowest support for any military excursion in the last, like, decade and a half. So that's actually really interesting. And also, 83% of editorials on the Syria strike supported the bombing. 15% took an ambivalent position. Only 2% said the attack shouldn't have happened. So, you know, when it comes push to shove, it's like Hillary would have done the exact same thing. She would have done it quicker. This is actually why people voted for Trump. They didn't want him to go to war with Syria. They wanted a detente with Russia. And so for him to do a 180 that quickly really shows the power of all the people he's appointed around him, these generals. He has more generals in any cabinet since, like, World War II. I mean, it's disgusting. So he is just a completely vacuous puppet who is leading wherever people tell him to go, Eugene. Yeah. And that's the scariest thing. And all we know is that he lives for media praise. This is the most important point, you know. He cares whether people like him. That's what we've seen. He goes out and he's like, why is CNN making fun of me? He's like, you guys are fake news. Please praise me, praise me. So now what does he know? Like a child with positive reinforcement, he just knows that if he bombs countries and carries out military excursions, then he's going to get bipartisan showering praise and compliments. You know, this whole media selling of war is why I actually became an advocacy journalist, because back in the Iraq invasion, I was so confused why we were already in Afghanistan, and we were all of a sudden talking about Iraq, and it's even more surreal than today, because at least the chemical weapons attack is like kind of fresh in people's mind. Saddam did the gassing of his own people when we were boys with them, a decade before we even tried to push that war. So it made actually less sense, and the media didn't question it at all. They completely sold the war bipartisan. I was absolutely stunned with why the media was acting as a de facto state media, called itself a free press, and ever since then, I've been working in media to try to change this insanely destructive and toxic narrative.
Mm-hmm. And I think that's a good point, because I mean, you were actually somebody who, people who don't know your history, I mean, you just were someone who just grassroots on your own jumped into it, started covering stuff and telling people the truth. And I mean, just the difficulty of, if you want to speak to this, you find, I mean, it's not like CNN, CBS or whatever are constantly calling you up, trying to put you on. I mean, you've really had to kind of break into the media sphere, which I feel like is such a telling commentary.
Absolutely. No, my God. I mean, and even when I did break briefly into the mainstream media after, of course, RT picked me up, RT was the only mainstream network that was at Occupy Wall Street covering it seriously. As I remember, Aaron Burnett was calling it a joke. You know, all these networks are funded by banks. Mm. I guess it's not that surprising when you see the financial investment in the corporate media and why they mocked Occupy so much. But yeah, I mean, even when I was at RT and I interviewed by Der Spiegel, all these outlets around the world that were taking me seriously, that do take RT seriously because they understand that Russia is a very important geopolitical player and their media is just as valid as CNN. So when the Crimea thing came out and I was briefly entertained by these outlets, quickly that changed when they realized that I wouldn't toe the line, that I wouldn't just become another puppet to speak out against Russia. And it didn't fit very neatly into their package, so they quickly turned to smearing me. And that's what they do. You see it happening with Tulsi Gabbard right now. I mean, they're all calling to throw her out of office simply because she is questioning who carried out the attack.
Right.
That's the world we're living in, where you just simply question the intelligence of an agency that's been literally falsifying events. You can go back to the Gulf of Tonkin. I mean, every impetus of any sort of military intervention has been either falsified, constructed, exaggerated, yet we're supposed to just trust the CIA all of a sudden and be like, sure, they wouldn't lie to me. And it's all just in the ether. It's like, oh, well, we don't have actual tangible evidence about Russia hacking the election or who carried out the chemical attack, but sure, why not? Because the CIA don't lie.
Right. Of all people to like say, and it just really, you know, just 2013, just a few years ago, we had like the massive Snowden disclosures that were basically just like, yeah, these people are lying about everything. They're spying on you. You're doing this. And then all of a sudden, I don't even know. Now everything is hunky dory. And because the 17 intelligence agencies all have quote unquote high confidence, it must be true. Really just, it's a bizarro world in so many different ways. But, you know, one other thing I'm curious about in terms of this, I mean, I kind of call it a media blockade around a lot of the things that I think are important that don't really get heavily covered. How are you viewing social media as a transition tool, as a transmission tool? I mean, is it – obviously, it's a way to sort of get around to some degree the traditional media gatekeepers, but then I guess, you know, it also elevates the internet companies to a different level. But as someone who's getting a lot of content out via the internet, via social media, I mean, how are you sort of seeing that aspect of it?
Yeah, I mean, look, it's like on one hand, I think that Twitter is the best way to, you know, either follow just individual journalists or you're not like lumped into following actual news agencies and you can really get a direct feed of all the news and the people that you really care about. And I tell people like that is the most direct way that you can actually get a filtered news and become media literate in terms of your consumption on a day-to-day basis. But we don't know how long that's going to last. I mean, already we see a widespread content control and guidelines being enacted that never were before. Simply swearing on a tweet can get your account blocked, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But when it comes to Facebook, and yeah, I mean, it's very scary because it's like when you put all of your trust into these corporations, and you know, it goes along with the whole we don't hear a lot of criticism of private corporations dealing with encryption or spying. It's only like we focus on the government and the NSA. These corporations don't give a crap about our privacy. They're just trying to make money. And in light of the Vault 7 revelation, we kind of saw that whole San Bernardino unlocking the iPhone was a ruse, that the government could always do that, and that Apple, I don't know if they knew that or not, but it kind of shows that this whole like ploy with the tug and pull with these corporations and the government, and they're looking out for us. I think it's all BS. So Twitter could go south very quickly. In terms of Facebook, it's super dangerous, and I think that the Google search algorithms are really dangerous too. And this was a story in Project Censored compilation this year, was how search algorithms are actually hurting democracy in many ways, and I think it's beyond even what we understand. There was some research from the American Institute for Behavioral Research on what they call search engine manipulation effect. It's called SEME, and they just like did different samples around the world of Google PageRank, Facebook EdgeRank, systems and had people in India look up certain things as opposed to America, as opposed to other countries, and they got vastly different results. And it wasn't just that they were logged into certain services right. or whatever, and that filtered them. It actually is different for different people. There was a study of 4,500 undecided voters using randomized controlled double-blind methods, and the results were shocking. I mean, they said that essentially these people are saying that this could shift the voting preferences of undecided voters by 20% or more, and it could be wow. even greater in some demographic groups because this is all masked. I mean, the search ranking biases are masks. People have no concept that they're being manipulated at all in terms of what they're seeing and why. So I honestly think that is a huge, huge problem that no one's talking about. And I don't really know the answer other than just, again, becoming media literate. Don't just depend on Facebook for like a news wrap-up. Like, obviously, everything's being filtered. And, of course, in the age of fake news with this hysterical mantra, that's going to be even worse. Mm-hmm. And we see even content creators across YouTube. They're already being demonetized. My friend Kyle Kalinske's channel, I mean, he simply just talks about news and politics. It's like you have people out there saying Miley Cyrus is part of the Illuminati and like going through these Pizzagate things, and they haven't been demonetized as far as I know. It's like people with a news and politics banner, and if they just simply have the tag ISIS or Syria or Iraq, it's odd because it's like, are you just demonetizing people that may be questioning the war narratives? Like, what's going on here? And, of course, this is all under the banner of fighting fake news. Right. And now I just read an article that unless you get 100,000 views on a video, you can't even get monetized. Mm. And we're talking about this is the only way that some of these independent content creators can make a living in our capitalist, screwed-up world.
Wow.
So it's nuts.
Yeah, no, I mean, it is. I heard as much about that search algorithm piece. That's definitely, you know, a very scary thing. Barrett Brown told me on this show when I interviewed him, the thing that scared him the most was that since the media itself was so, the mainstream media is so like event driven, just reacting to whatever big story that there was because of all the proliferation of all this technology and search engines like that, that he was just afraid that people could start to create events, knowing that the CNNs and the MSNBCs will pick them up and blow them up. And then they can, you know, sort of ride off the consequences of that, which sounds, to me like a much more, the whole thing, very scary.
Oh, totally. Yeah. And then it's weird too. Like when you see the way it works on Twitter, you can see just like the million, and like these people have massive amounts of money. I always think, you know, we talk about the government spying and government infiltration of trolls online. What about BP? You know, what about these corporations? Can you imagine the amount of money that they have and the ability that they have to shape the perception online? They probably have troll armies too, and people downvoting, you know, taking over comment boards. I mean, all of these things could vastly influence our opinions without even us realizing it. And there could be very nefarious actors behind the scenes, Eugene.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. No, I think that's very true. That's very true. And I think, you know, the importance of narrative is so key in the way things are done. And I think you know this quite well. I mean, for example, now if you question anything in the Syria narrative that's coming from the mainstream media, you know, you're Assad's press agent. If you say anything about the Russia investigation, you're just working for Putin. But then, you know, I opened up the New York Times this morning, and you've got Thomas Friedman in there talking about how ISIS is basically America's ally. And I feel very confident that no one will call him a terrorist sympathizer this week. And it's just like, so wait a second, this guy can just be like, yeah, ISIS is good, and no one blinks an eye in the New York Times. But like, you know, if I just say like, hey, maybe there's a little question about some element of this other story, oh my God, da 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 da, five alarms, you know, bells are ringing or whatever.
Again, this is it's the Louise Mensch syndrome. It's like you can put someone in there who's the craziest mofo in Washington, so insane that he's calling ISIS good, essentially. I mean, I implore everyone to read this article. Mm. It's nuts. We have a guy saying, you know, he's like, you know, let's take a step back here. He's like, Rex Tillerson, all these people can agree on one thing. He's like, that ISIS is really bad, right? It's like, yeah, I thought that's what the whole war on terror was about, right, Friedman? And he's like, but you know what? Why? He's like, can I just pose a question? Why is ISIS our number one threat in Syria? And then he just basically goes off on a giant thought experiment about how the Trump we know and hate, that's the Trump we need in Syria. A completely wow. bellicose, bumbling, crazy person who essentially just tries to make some bizarre deal and with, you know, Russia, Iran, and Syria to, you know, this is what Kerry did. Mm. You know, going back to hold the strategy of how did we get here? Documents came out, and I actually wrote this down because I didn't want to screw it up, but This was actually in a leaked audio that Mr. Kerry, Secretary of State, was talking about how this was a strategy to let ISIS flourish and grow. I mean, even during the Mosul operation, they like left that back door open to Syria. I mean, this has been a strategy from the State Department, from the CIA, for years and years and years as a counter strategy to try to oust Assad. They wanted ISIS to thrive and grow in Syria. So don't give me this stuff, Friedman, to sit back and say, oh, you know, let's just see what happens. Why let's ISIS is basically better than having Assad. I mean, I've heard this argument. It's completely ludicrous, Eugene. It's so much more common than I would like it to be, where we're actually intelligent people, not Friedman, but I mean, even on other outlets, alternative outlets, are even entertaining. Like, what would be better, ISIS or Assad? It's like, are you kidding me? What do you mean, what would be better? What are you talking about? The Syrian state is the only thing standing in between, like, widespread massacres of minorities. It's unbelievable, Eugene. And look no further than, you know, you want to question war narratives. Look at Libya. This is a place that has, like, slave institutions now where there's so many black markets because it's just in light of such a failed state. The justification for that no-fly zone and bombing campaign was another kind of similar thing to the Syria thing. It's like Gaddafi's going to carry out a massacre in Benghazi, right? And so 5 years later, after the country's a failed state, after ISIS has overrun it and strengthened, and now ISIS is strengthened in Syria and Iraq, 5 years later, the UK Parliament releases a report and says, yeah, that whole massacre thing, that was fake. That was never going to happen. So, yeah, that sucks. I guess we shouldn't have bombed Libya and destroyed the country because, let's move on to Syria. It's like, where are all those commentators? Where are the Friedmans that called for overthrowing Gaddafi? Where are they? Oh, they've been totally silent. They moved on to Syria right after it was over.
Right.
What do they have to say now for what's going on there? And they want to cause another one?
Right. No, it's unbelievable. Well, while we have you here at the few minutes left, I don't want to leave off doing this because obviously, as I mentioned, you are the host and creator of the Empire Files, and people should go to theempirefiles.tv. I mean, you guys have covered so much. I mean, I feel like you've already sort of torn the Empire a new one. But what are some of the things that people should be looking for that you have coming up?
Well, what we like to do with the show, Eugene, is we like to compile the context, a deeper context to all of these issues. A lot of superficialities are thrown around on the corporate media, and things are coming at us at such a rapid pace that it's really hard to dissect and kind of peel back the layers, especially with Trump's just executive power. Really shocking, right? So many things are happening. We can't keep up. So sometimes it's important to take a step back, and this is one of the reasons that I wanted to shift over to investigative journalism, having the time to really kind of unarchive these chapters that have been censored or hidden, or, you know, the victors wrote the history books, and it also was written by men. And so we like to retell the stories of history. What has the empire done through the lens of the marginalized and oppressed? Talking about how war and inequality and capital shapes the planet, how does imperialism work? So all of these really deep issues that yes, they're happening every day, and you need to understand why. You need to understand how they can be stopped, and how they're going to keep going unless we understand the root structure of why all these things fit together. So it's a really great opportunity to put these things together. But some of the things we've been covering, we're doing a series on Palestine, because of course Palestine is one of those issues that is the cause and the root of so many problems in the Middle East, and people think of it as this complex issue. It's one of the most complicated issues in the world. Well, actually, it's the most simple, one of the most simple issues to explain also. So we have a series that everyone can check out. It's a 6-part series from our trip in the West Bank. We also have a feature documentary on Steve Bannon. He likes to call himself an economic nationalist. We explain why economic nationalism in his eyes is white nationalism and why he is so dangerous. He actually foresees us going to war with China in the next 5 years. He thinks Islam is also, the whole clash of civilizations thing. So we really dissect him. And yeah, everyone's heard a lot about Bannon, but no one's really put together every single horrible thing that he's said and done in one piece. And that's what we really pride ourselves on, is really digging in there and putting together everything you need to know about one subject. So I really encourage everyone to check it out on the empirefiles.tv, on our YouTube channel, Empire Files, Facebook, Twitter, and all the rest.
Yes, absolutely. And I really, really hope folks do the same. I have to say the episode on the border, one of my favorites, really just stunning. Everyone should watch that. All of them, of course, TheEmpireFiles.tv. We're going to have to leave it there for today with Abby Martin, but we are going to take a break and come back with one more segment here on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier. Stay with us.
By any means necessary.
Back to By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Perrier, and as always, we're your guide to connecting the political, social, and economic movements shaping the world around us. And today we are talking about, well, a number of things, the serious strikes, other foreign policy implications out of that. And then just coming into this, we've gotten some new information about a major bomb strike there in Afghanistan. And we are very happy to be joined by Mr. Daniel McAdams, who's the executive director of the Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity. Mr. McAdams, thank you for joining us again.
Thanks for having me back on.
No, of course, of course. And sort of the big news, this is just breaking, so I don't know if you've seen it. I'll sort of just explain to you what took place here. It seems that it's coming out that earlier today in Afghanistan, the United States has dropped a MOAB, a mother of all bombs, as you know well, the one just below the nuclear weapons on allegedly some sort of ISIS facility in Afghanistan. The damage is still somewhat unknown. But really, I think it was just sort of a shocking thing about the Trump administration that they seem to just be willing to wantonly use U.S. power, regardless of the consequences.
Well, yeah, I had indeed seen that, and I think the irony, if you want to call it that, is that 16 years into a war, the mightiest military on earth against a bunch of Afghani farmers, 16 years into that war, we dropped the largest non-nuclear weapon in the world against an ISIS fortified compound that wasn't even there when the war started. So that just tells you how completely messed up U.S. foreign policy is.
Yeah, no, I think that's a very good point. It's a very good point. And, I wonder, one of the things that's interesting to me in just sort of this entire thing that's taking place here with the Trump administration. I mean, looking at the Syria strike, one of the things I thought is a lot of people are comparing it to what happened in the lead up to Iraq. But I thought to myself this morning, I said, well, you know, Bush at least made a pretense of going to the United Nations, going to Congress. And I mean, he lied about what he was trying to do, but he at least went there. And it made me think that, I mean, is this a sign of Trump just kind of going and launching the strikes on Syria and doing these different pieces without consulting the UN, without consulting the Constitution, that the sort of quote-unquote imperial presidency is really in full swing?
I think it says some worrisome things about his character, you know, his willingness to act first and then look for evidence later. And I think this is coming back to Burnham, because I think we are seeing the official story falling apart, seeing, certainly the White House report is extraordinarily flimsy. It relies on things like Twitter, Al-Qaeda, and the white helmets as its evidence. So that's not a real good trio to deal with. I don't know how it's going to play out, but we also saw this this report from the MIT professor that said, sorry, looking at the ballistics of this, it just does not make sense. So he's going to find himself burned, I think, pretty soon.
Yeah, no, I think you're 100% right there. I mean, I think it seems that they sort of stepped out there. They were doing more than what they needed to. I mean, it's interesting to see now in Congress, though, so much of the opposition. I mean, there's been some people who have been sort of opposed on process grounds, but, you know, really only, you know, I think in both houses, maybe four or five people, I'm trying to think of them off the top of my head, have really spoken up about the substance of what's going on in Syria. I mean, what does that say about the state of Congress right now?
Well, it's sad. I mean, they're afraid of being labeled weak or unpatriotic. I mean, you mentioned Iraq. It's like we're back to that again, where people like Ron Paul and Barbara Lee and a few others were labeled as weak and wimpy and unpatriotic because they didn't want to rush into a war. Well, guess what? They were all proven right. And so I guess you get no points for being proven right, because here we are going about the whole thing again, and Congress is too cowardly to step up and do their job, to demand the president make his case and request a declaration of war or not.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And you know, I'm always curious in these sorts of situations because, you know, having never worked in Congress and you worked in Congress, how is it with these intelligence agencies and these Pentagon people? I mean, do they just kind of come and push stuff down people's throats? Are they trying to convince people of stuff? I mean, what kind of pressure do they put on people in Congress to kind of see things their way?
Well, a lot of members that we heard who went into the intelligence briefings before the Iraq war, and I think some of them have even said this publicly, it's a dog and pony show when you get in there. They show you what they want you to see. They explain very complex things in a way that makes their conclusions seem inevitable. So it's also a very easy way to bamboozle people. There's something, you know, very secretive and sexy about intelligence and satellite photos and things, and it makes people feel very important that they have access to it. And I think the intelligence agencies know that, and they exploit that to the advantage, unfortunately, of a war machine.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And those shared assumptions, I mean, are so huge. I mean, watching Bernie Sanders over the weekend talk about the whole situation with Chuck Todd, what was interesting to me is that when sort of Todd is questioning him, as he said, and he's sort of pushing back on whether or not the strikes would work, he said something along the lines of, well, of course we have to do something about Assad. And I've heard like a million people say that. But then I'm thinking, well, why of course? And that to some degree, like part, maybe this, I don't know if it's the original sin here, but part of the issue in how we discuss, part of the problem in how we discuss these issues is this sort of like base level mainstream media assumption that whether you're for the strikes in Syria, whether you're against the strikes, we all recognize that like we must do regime change, which just seems like a little bit of a flawed framework.
Yeah, you know, they do accept conventional wisdom. They don't question it at all. But the fact of the matter is either he did it or he didn't do it. If he did it, it makes him a very bad person. It makes him basically a psychopathic person to kill civilians for fun. But it's still not an issue for the United States to respond to. People are killed, unfortunately, throughout the world by evil leaders. And there's no way that we jump to everyone's rescue in that case, in those cases. If he didn't do it, which I think is more likely the case, because it simply makes no sense that he did it and hasn't done it in the past, despite what people say about the 2013 Ghouta bombings, the UN never concluded that he was responsible for those, despite what people say. But if he didn't do it, all the more so, the danger of conventional wisdom driving policy in a very destructive direction.
And one of the things I'm curious for your thoughts on here that I just thought was interesting, I thought it was a big irony in terms of the way it played out, is, you know, throughout the whole campaign, Hillary Clinton said, well, you know, Trump isn't a responsible commander-in-chief. He won't know what he's doing. He will act irresponsibly and so on and so forth. And then here we are, and as it concerns Syria and to some degree Russia, you know, he's doing more or less exactly what she either said should be done or is on record sometime in the past saying should be our strategy towards something. I mean, it really just does seem ironic to me.
No matter who you vote for, the war party wins, right? Yeah, you know, she was calling for something, some bombing on Syria just a couple of hours before Trump did it. I would like to think that, you know, Hillary is evil but not stupid. I think she probably would have found a better way to make a case than to just talk about beautiful babies while she's watching TV and this sort of thing. So she probably would have handled it better. But yeah, they would have done the same thing.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, certainly there's a bipartisan reality, it seems like, the war machine here in the United States. I mean, you know, one other aspect to me of this whole thing and perhaps one sort of big casualty of this whole Syria strike especially was the dignity of the U.S. media. I mean, the just obsequiousness towards what was going on. I mean, the whole Brian Williams thing about the power and the beauty of – I don't even know what that was about. That was just like a very bizarre moment. And, I mean, it just seems like, man, what is going on with the U.S. media?
There was a great clip. I don't know if you've seen it or your listeners have seen it, but it was Representative Thomas Massie on CNN. And this was right after it happened. And he said, look, we don't have any evidence. There hasn't been an investigation. And the presenter's eyes opened five times wider, and she just could not believe that someone would say this, would question this. Do you mean you don't believe this is what he did? Well, we need some evidence. And the same thing happened to Tulsi Gabbard. You know, she spoke up and said, you know, I'm pretty skeptical. I need to see some evidence. And her own party wants to kick her out of Congress. So it just goes to show that people that do stand up, you know, the media is on their back.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And looking at Trump himself, I mean, someone who campaigned on the issue of sort of non-intervention, you know, not going deeper into Syria, maybe having more collaboration with Russia against ISIS. I mean, sort of breaking the mold to some degree here. I mean, how are you sort of evaluating, you know, not only the way the Syria thing is playing out, but the sort of bellicosity towards North Korea? I mean, it almost seems like, you know, Trump has now turned into something of a neocon.
Yeah, it certainly sounds that way. And I think, you know, a lot of it has to do with the advisors that he surrounded himself with. McMaster's his national security advisor, I think, is close to Petraeus, who, you know, let's not forget, lost in everything that he's put his hand in as a commander, as a general, a complete failed person, but he's always in favor of more interventions. And so I think these are the people that are whispering in Trump's ear or yelling in Trump's ear. And I think one of Trump's weaknesses may well be the fact that he listens to what the last person he talks to told him. So that makes him very lonely. That's what happens when you operate without a philosophy. He doesn't have a philosophy. He doesn't have a worldview. And so he's very susceptible then to suggestion. I think that might be what's happening.
Yeah, no, I think that's certainly the case. And I'm actually glad you raised that issue of Petraeus and these other generals. I mean, it is sort of a strange thing how, I mean, and I think that was like one thing that a lot of Trump's critics were saying they were comforted by in the transition process. Well, oh, he's bringing in these generals and these generals know what's going on. But I mean, all of the Mattis, John Kelly, McMaster, it's not as if these people have just been like running around the world winning wars gangbusters. I mean, in fact, it's the exact opposite, yet and still, you know, they're held up as these sort of sacrosanct voices.
Yeah, that's true. We have an article up on the Institute, Walpole Institute website today by Mike Sawyer, where he talks about that exact thing. You know, these generals are, you know, they can't wait to get out of the Pentagon and get on boards of these military industrial complex companies making millions and millions of dollars, seen somehow as objective experts on these things, when in fact it feathers their nest. It lines their pockets, and they live off of war and conflict. So, you know, what Sawyer said is, Trump, if you're going to survive, you've got to purge these generals and get rid of them. Probably a good idea.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I'm glad you actually mentioned Mike Sawyer, because I'm always thinking about people like him and Philip Giraldi and Bill Binney and Ray McGovern and, you know, people who were so – I mean, so many of the people who raise skeptical questions about these issues, when you – I mean, high, high-level people in, you know, the intelligence agencies, in the military, people whose records and experience – unparalleled. But then, you know, here I'm sitting in our studio and, you know, we have on the TV. I don't think I've ever seen one of these people on MSNBC for sure. I don't think on CNN. I saw Bill Binney one time on Fox News, and I did see John Kiriakou one time on CNN. So, I mean, it's like you have this wealth of knowledge, professionals, people who are available, who've been in the space. No one's talking to them. But for whatever reason, the mainstream media is bringing on these like national security talking heads that like, who are these people?
Yeah, it's, you know, it's just, they're not serving the purpose of the fourth estate in our society. They're serving the purpose of bolstering the state, the national security state. So they really do serve as propaganda. And if it weren't for the internet, if it weren't for alternative sources, which of course are growing all the time, if it weren't for that, people would be completely brainwashed. But thankfully, there still is some access, and there's increasing access to alternative sources, and people are tuning out from the mainstream sources. You know, their numbers are down. So. Mm-hmm. Hopefully people are waking up.
And I'm curious how you're reading this escalation in East Asia. I mean, I think that, you know, Trump has tried to present it as not much of an escalation and just sort of sending a message here. But, I mean, it sort of seems like even maybe more so than the Middle East, the kind of great power conflict tinderbox is so huge and so big there. So to send this, not only send a carrier battle group, but call it an armada, as Trump did, seems somewhat ominous to me.
Well, if, you know, everyone says that that Kim Jong-un is unstable, and if he is so unstable mentally, then why would you want to provoke someone like that with this sort of thing? You know, it just goes back to lack of worldview. If he really wanted to, quote, defeat North Korea, you know, we should sort of kill him with kindness. Let's open the borders. Let's travel and trade with them. You know, let's open things up. Let's let the South Koreans travel to North Korea and meet their relatives. All of these things would go a lot further. Kind of like what we're seeing in Cuba now, after all these decades of blockades and sanctions, now opening it up a little bit, it's having a positive effect. So it's too bad he won't learn from that.
Yeah, no, I mean, it's an interesting piece. I mean, and doesn't it to some degree speak to a lot of maybe the issue in the way we look at it is it's always, you know, the way things are promoted, it's the Russians, it's the North Koreans, it's the Chinese, it's all this, as if these aren't huge countries with huge numbers of people and that kind of people-to-people diplomacy and people starting to get to know each other and having relations and building ties and bonds. It just seems like that's a much more logical way to operate some sort of foreign policy or relationship with someone than to just blanketly say, like, all, you know, 140 million Russians, however many they are just like the enemy of the United States.
Well, there's almost a sort of a national psychosis in America, and I don't know what causes it. Maybe it's Americans, by and large, do not travel enough to other countries. But there's this sort of national psychosis of exceptionalism that means whatever we do is great, and everyone else out there envies us and wants to destroy us. You know, we have the Hitler of the Month Club, where everyone that we don't like is a Hitler. And it is a very dangerous and very pathological way of seeing the world. And it's I don't know what will break it. Certainly the media and politicians like to reinforce it because it reinforces their grip on power and control over us.
Mm. You know, Trump now came out saying that he supports the accession of Montenegro to NATO. I mean, this just seems like one of maybe the most short-sighted things that he's done so far. Like, the only result of this can be to, like, further inflame the U.S.-Russia tensions at a moment where perhaps they couldn't be more further inflamed.
Well, the funniest thing about his statement on Montenegro is he said something like, the wishes of the Montenegrin people should not be thwarted by big powers. The fact of the matter is they didn't allow a referendum on NATO accession to the Montenegrin people. They weren't allowed to express their view on it because they probably would have voted no. It was certainly split pretty much down the middle, 50-50. So the whole thing about the Montenegrin people speaking is a joke. That wasn't at all what the case is. And as you point out, it is about Russia. It's about NATO not having a purpose and needing to expand, needing fresh blood, the U.S. needing to sell more weapons. So it's, you know, it makes no sense. But, you know, it's part of the plan to encircle Russia. Montenegro's first, and others will follow.
Yeah, no, I think that's a very good point in terms of the way this thing is playing out. And I mean, it just sort of seems that, I mean, that's a huge issue that Trump has sort of walked back. The whole NATO is obsolete, which I mean, I certainly would agree with that. And now he came out and said, oh no, NATO is not obsolete. I was just sort of saying that, but you know, now I see that it has a mission. But I mean, I don't know. I'm curious what you think. What is the mission? It doesn't seem like there's any real credible reason why this structure would exist in the 21st century.
Well, it kind of goes back to that theory that Trump just says what the last person he met with told him to say. Because here he is sitting down with this horrible neocon, Jens Stoltenberg, the Secretary General of NATO, and he emerges from the meeting and says, oh, you know, I changed my mind. NATO's great. I'm all for it. You know, it's because this guy gave him a song and dance about how wonderful NATO is. I mean, I thought Trump was supposed to be this hard-nosed businessman, this great negotiator. On these fronts, he's kind of disappointing, I think. He's not doing very good. As for the purpose of NATO, the purpose of NATO is to milk the taxpayers of all the member countries into providing wonderful, lucrative jobs for the people that are involved in the bureaucracy and also for the military-industrial complex. It does absolutely nothing to protect the United States. If anything, it's the opposite. It gets us into more trouble than anything else.
Mm-hmm. And you know what? I think this final question here or comment, but I'm curious your thoughts too. I'm glad you said that because to me, the most telling fact about how effective or ineffective all of these sort of world police policies are is in 2008 and 2012, and I know you know this very well, it was Dr. Ron Paul who got the most donations from active duty service members. And I just said, if there was ever a statement about the futility of these wars and all these different occupations and interventions, that was it right there.
Yeah, the people who have to fight them are not that awfully keen. And the neocons wouldn't know which end of the gun to pick up. Very keen always to send other people's kids to war. So that's why they're so despicable.
Absolutely. Well, certainly, I really appreciate you joining the show here. That was Mr. Danny McAdams. He's the executive director of the Ron Paul Institute for Peace and Prosperity. That is going to do it for us here on By Any Means Necessary on Radio Sputnik in Washington, D.C. I'm your host, Eugene Puryear. See you next time.
By any means necessary.